From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. The U.S. has passed 4 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. That's up 1 million from just 2 weeks ago, which means the total number of cases in the country has doubled since early June. More than 144,000 people have died.
And the surge has led President Trump to do a 180 on the part of the Republican National Convention that he moved out of North Carolina and into Jacksonville, Florida. He now says that's canceled.
The timing for this event is not right. It's just not right with what's happened recently, the flare up in Florida. To have a big convention, it's not the right time. It's really something that, for me, I have to protect the American people. That's what I've always done. That's what I always will do. That's what I'm about.
Let's get to that and more in politics with Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Toluz Olurunipa, White House reporter at The Washington Post. Welcome to both of you. And Rick, in addition to the convention, the president also conceded that schools in some hotspot areas shouldn't necessarily reopen after he had been saying that they should. Is he being pressured just by the numbers of coronavirus cases or by his poll numbers into taking this more seriously than he has?
These are striking reversals, and it's as if reality has crashed in on President Trump's world. I mean, he's the one that wanted the big party in Jacksonville, despite what experts had told him. He's the one that's been insisting on schools reopening entirely, despite what experts have told him. And I think it's the reality of the disease, and I do think it's the political reality as well. There's no question that he has taken a real hit in public and private polling as a result of being basically where the country is in terms of this disease. And I think people have been prevailing on him to change course, and I think we're starting to see that now in terms of his rhetoric as well as his actions.
Well, and that tape that we just played was from one of these coronavirus daily press briefings that he has restarted this week. Tolu, they didn't help him the last time around. We remember people were telling him to stop doing them because they were hurting him in the polls. Do you expect they'll be any different this time?
Well, they have tried to reconfigure the way the briefings take place. The president has been spending less time in front of the press. These briefings have been lasting on average less than 30 minutes, where before he would go almost 2 hours speaking extemporaneously. Now he's going after following a script and not taking as many questions and trying to be a little bit more somber in tone, if you will. But it's not clear that this will change much in terms of the president's political standing, in part because, as we've seen in a large number of polls that have been released in the last few days, the American people give him very low marks for his handling of this virus, and for that reason, he is trailing in the polls.
Tolu, I want to bring in something else that's happening this week. The pandemic unemployment benefits run out in a week. That's the extra $600 a week that Congress gave unemployed Americans in the CARES Act. Roughly 30 million workers are currently claiming unemployment benefits. That's one in five workers. And we're seeing unemployment filings tick back up again, as we've been reporting. Is that enough pressure to get movement from Congress and the White House? I mean, what's the holdup here?
Yeah, there's a lot of pushback, especially from Republicans, against this idea of giving people expanded unemployment benefits. The idea or the problem, the concern among Republicans is that some people, a large number of these people who are actually receiving this benefit, are making more by not working than they were making while they were working. That may be an issue to look at, you know, in terms of a living wage and the fact that wages are so low for so many Americans, even before the pandemic. But Republicans say that people need incentives to work. They don't need incentives not to work. And for that reason, this could be a big showdown, a big fight that can make it very hard to pass a phase four bill, because Democrats want to continue giving this $600 additional benefit, saying it's a lifeline that many people would have been evicted from their homes, would have gone homeless, and would have had trouble putting food on the table without this money. And Republicans are saying that this money is keeping people from going back to work. And I don't see that bridge being those differences being bridged in the next few days. It's a major fight, and the White House has also tried to push back against that as well.
Rick, I mean, what's happening with the GOP right now? I mean, Democrats passed this $3 trillion relief bill in the House back in May, but we have yet to see this bill from Republicans in the Senate. What's going on here?
Well, the Republicans are having trouble deciding what they want is the next phase of this. And the president changing course, he's also been all over the map in terms of what specifically he wants to be in the next bill. And I think it's an embarrassment for Republicans to have to go into the weekend knowing that there's a short legislative window, that the political season is upon us, without really even having a bill. The Senate Republicans haven't been able to come up with something yet. There's some framework out there. I think it all fits into where the party is right now, which is you have a lot of folks who are looking at the president's political prospects, beginning to position around him, maneuver around him, and begin to make calculations that aren't necessarily connected to the president's daily musings on Twitter or elsewhere.
I'm so glad that your line stayed together there, Rick, because you said, I think it's, and then we lost you for a second. I'm like, oh, what did he think? But anyway, I'm going to go to Tolu next for the next question, which is on the issue of Republicans in Congress. Tolu, there does seem to be some infighting going on in the party. President Trump has gone after Wyoming's Congresswoman Liz Cheney, the third highest ranking Republican in the House. Other Republicans are also going after her. Now, we remember that she has defended Dr. Fauci. She said real men wear masks and posted a photo of her father, Dick Cheney. What is the significance of this infighting in the Republican Party, Tolu?
Yeah, it's a big question about what the Republican Party stands for in 2020 in the age of Donald Trump. And right now, loyalty to Trump is the coin of the realm within the Republican Party, showing that you're loyal to the president, showing that you will stand with him and stand by him no matter what, even if he goes against party orthodoxy. And that seems to be rubbing some Republicans the wrong way. People like Liz Cheney want to be able to show that they have their own independent voices. And there's also this big fight over what's going to happen if President Trump loses and what is the Republican Party going to look like in a post-Trump era. And that's part of the machinations that you're seeing. It's part of the jostling you're seeing in the party is that President Trump right now is down in the polls. And if he loses in just over 100 days, then there's going to be a mad scramble as to who's going to be a leader in the party that has been defined by loyalty to Trump over the last 3 years.
Rick, let's talk about what happened this week with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the New York Democratic congresswoman who spoke on the House floor yesterday to read a statement about her encounter with Republican Representative Ted Yoho of Florida.
There were reporters in the front of the Capitol, and in front of reporters, Representative Yoho called me, and I quote, bitch. These are the words that Representative Yoho levied against a congresswoman, the congresswoman that not only represents New York's 14th congressional district, but every congresswoman and every woman in this country.
Now, she also invited other Democratic women to talk about their experiences with harassment, including in Congress. Yoho has denied using that slur, even though there were witnesses, and he has since apologized for any, quote, misunderstanding. What has been the response to all of this, Rick?
This was a kind of moment that really cuts through. It's not just about a member of Congress and a colleague and some sharp words. This is about a younger woman and an older colleague and a slur that is probably all too familiar to women in the workplace. And I think that's a piece of this. And I think the fact that this happened among members of Congress or even could happen among members of Congress is a reminder of where we are as a country. I think it's a reminder we're all on edge. I think the coronavirus crisis has got people into another state of mind, and there's probably people snapping at friends and colleagues as well as political enemies along the way. But what I thought was so striking about this is that you have this 30-year-old woman talking about this experience and having a bunch of her colleagues support her on it and talk about it. So it's not just about the tensions in Congress. To me, it says something broader about the country.
With the time we have with you, Rick, I want to ask you about former Trump lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen. He's back out of prison again today. He was moved to home confinement because of the pandemic originally, then moved back to prison. But a judge said the second move was actually retaliatory because Cohen wanted to write this tell-all book about the president. What do we know about this and what happens now?
It's so striking to have a judge say that it looks like there was political considerations, retribution by the Justice Department. Look, Bill Barr and his Justice Department haven't given people a lot of confidence in their in his ability to keep politics out of things. We've seen example after example in terms of legislation as well as individual actions, including the Roger Stone commutation by the president himself. But this kind of idea that there's political retribution directly against someone who's going to write something critical is a really startling thing. And I think the fact that Michael Cohen is out again is because a judge has found as much and said that, that this was about political retribution first and foremost.
Yeah, Tolu, I know that you have been also covering this. I mean, this speaks to something that could potentially be larger. I mean, with the federal judge saying that this is truly a retaliatory move.
Yeah, it's hard to sort of overstate how important this ruling is when it comes to the First Amendment and when it comes to freedom of speech and the idea that the president or his acolytes were potentially using the power of the federal government, the power to imprison someone and put them in solitary confinement in order to violate their First Amendment rights. That is a monumental charge. It is fundamental to who we are as Americans. And if this is true, then it's clear that we've gone further away from our constitutional norms and values than many people would have even expected, even under the Trump presidency. So we'll wait to hear more, but the judge's ruling is very disturbing.
That is Tolu Olorunipa, The Washington Post, and Rick Klein at ABC News. Thanks to both of you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now, where independent minds get their start.
Next week, law graduates across the country would be taking the bar exam. But this year, because of the coronavirus pandemic, about half of the states have delayed the exam or moved it online. Others have canceled it. So what does this mean for would-be lawyers? Joining us now is Karen Sloan, contributing editor at law.com. Karen, welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy. Glad to be here.
And just for our audience, people that maybe aren't familiar with this whole process, what is the bar exam, first of all, and why do people have to take it?
So the bar exam is a licensing exam that attorneys have to take and pass in order to practice law. So what typically will happen is law graduates, you know, you'll graduate from after 3 years of law school in May or June, and you will spend the next couple of months hunkered down studying for this. It's really a grueling test. It's, depending on the state that you're in, 2 or 3 days long. And you'll have hundreds or thousands of people who get together in convention centers and these large spaces over the course of a couple of days to take this pretty intense exam. And it's high stakes, because if you fail, then, you know, you have to retake it 6 months later. And during that time, you can't do what you want, which is to practice as a lawyer.
So what have states decided to do? They're not all doing the same thing with the bar, but give us a sense of what they're doing because of COVID-19.
We've got about half of them that are actually next week, somewhat as planned, they're going to be giving their bar exam. People are going to be showing up in person for 2 days and taking this test. So the jurisdictions, the states that are doing that, tend to be the smaller ones, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Arkansas. Then you have states that were planning to give the July bar exam, but then said, look, COVID's getting bad. We're going to delay the test. We're going to give an in-person exam, but we're going to wait until September. And then you have a whole different category of states, California, Georgia, Pennsylvania. A growing number of these states have decided we're going to do it online over 2 days in October instead.
And how does an online bar exam work?
That's a good question, because it's never been done before. There's a couple of different approaches. We have some states like Michigan and Indiana and Nevada and Florida that are actually devising their own state-specific bar exam. The rest of the states that are waiting until October are giving a test that's prepared by the National Conference of Bar Examiners. Some of the concerns out there are, am I going to be able to find a quiet place in my house to take this test over the course of 2 days? I mean, a lot of people are still hunkered down with their families. Some people have little kids running around. There's a big concern about what happens if my internet goes out during the test. And then there's some security questions, too, because these states are planning to use remote proctoring technology. You're monitored through your computer, through your microphone, and through your computer's camera. And there are people actually watching you take this test to make sure that you don't cheat. There's a lot of unknowns out there right now. And I think there's a fair bit of skepticism that these online tests are really going to go off as planned.
Well, New York just announced yesterday that the bar exam will be given online in October.
Right. So there are, and just so your listeners know, New York is the single largest bar exam jurisdiction in the country. Mm-hmm. Typically in July, they'll have 10,000 people sit for their bar exam. So New York was planning to give an in-person bar exam in September. But last week they said, look, there's no way to do this. You know, New York has 14-day quarantines in place for people coming from out of state, and COVID's, you know, still not under control. So we're not going to have the bar exam in September. But they also didn't tell people what the new plan was.
One thing New York was considering doing is canceling the bar exam this year and extending something called emergency diploma privilege. Now, Louisiana, Washington, and Oregon are some of the states doing that. Explain what that means.
An emergency diploma privilege basically lets you become licensed as an attorney without having to take the bar exam. So there's a big push nationwide by law graduates for states to adopt these emergency diploma privileges. And there's also a lot of pushback from people within the legal profession saying, hold up, I know things are bad right now, but we have to have people take the bar exam to make sure that they're qualified to be attorneys.
Right. And we should point out also that a lot of lawyers that come right out of law school and maybe they get into a firm, they're going to be working most likely with other lawyers who have passed the bar exam. So even if they have this emergency diploma, it's not as if they're going to be working on their own for the most part, right?
Well, a lot of people do go into the law firm context, not everybody. But that's an interesting point that you bring up, because as a stopgap measure, we have seen a lot of states extend these, we call them supervised practice rules. Basically, if you can't take the bar exam, we will let you work under the supervision of a licensed attorney until you have a chance to take the bar exam.
Now, this is all happening after, presumably, these students have been studying for months for the bar exam, right? So what happens if they have to take it, let's say, many months from now or even a year from now? They're going to have to study all over again.
Right. I mean, that is one of the big stressors for law graduates right now. I sort of think about it as, you know, you're running a marathon and you've gone to law school for 3 years and you see the finish line, and then suddenly these states keep moving it back. Oh, you think you're done? Well, not really, because now the bar exam's in October, or, you know, some people may even have to wait till February to take it. So, you know, these are people who, a lot of them have jobs lined up, and some of them can't do those jobs until they have their licenses. And so they're facing some real economic hardships, not to mention just kind of the psychological stress that comes with all the uncertainty of not knowing when you're going to be able to pursue your professional future.
That is Karen Sloan, who is a contributing editor at law.com. Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This week, President Trump announced a plan to send federal agents to U.S. cities, including Chicago and Albuquerque, with the stated mission of fighting violent crime. It's called Operation Legend, and the Department of Justice says it has nothing to do with what's happening in Portland, Oregon, where federal agents are under investigation for their use of force against peaceful protesters. Those agents were videotaped seizing a protester and taking him away in an unmarked vehicle without explaining why. Democrats say this federal law enforcement action is political, part of the president's law and order reelection message. John Anderson is the U.S. Attorney for the District of New Mexico. He's coordinating Operation Legend in Albuquerque and joins us now. John Anderson, you have said this operation is not Portland. How are you going to make sure it isn't?
We're going to make sure by tailoring the operation to what it's intended to do, which is address violent crime and address gun violence. I want to be very clear that the operation in Albuquerque is not going to be targeted at protesters. It's not going to be targeted at limiting or infringing anybody's freedom of assembly or freedom of expression of any way. So by making sure that we have a targeted goal of the operation, which in this case is the reduction of gun violence in Albuquerque, it gives us a great deal of confidence that we are not going to see the same types of scenarios that we're seeing in Portland.
Are there written agreements to that effect on what the federal agents can and should do?
I have represented in writing, in particular to the district attorney, as to what the law enforcement, the scope of the law enforcement operation is going to be. In other words, it's going to be aimed at violent crime and gun violence in particular. We have existing memoranda of understanding with our state and local partners to discuss the goals of the joint task forces in which those law enforcement officers work together. So I believe there is certainly sufficient basis that I have explained what the law enforcement operation is going to focus on.
Tim Keller, the mayor of Albuquerque, told NPR this week that he is worried about what he called a secret police situation like Portland. Here he is.
That's not real crime fighting. It's politics standing in the way of actual police work to make our cities less safe. And as a mayor, I mean, I've been given no formal details or any explanation of what these officers would actually do. And so, of course, we're very concerned in the absence of that.
What do you say to the mayor there who clearly doesn't want this help from the federal government?
I don't want to put words in the mayor's mouth, but I think that in the past we have worked productively, and in the past he has expressed his appreciation for the existing partnerships between state and local law enforcement. So I'm not sure I'd say he clearly doesn't want it, but you'd have to ask him.
He says this is not real crime fighting. He said it's politics standing in the way of actual police work.
Sure. And I would disagree with him on that. I think when this begins, he'll see that it is real crime fighting. It's the same type of crime fighting we have been doing in Albuquerque for years now, working hand in hand with our state and local partners.
What about the bigger issue, though? You heard the word politics there. Many people are looking at this and saying, well, President Trump has announced this operation at the very same time that his reelection campaign is trying to brand him as the law and order candidate. What do you say to people who think this is just politics and it's an inappropriate use of the federal government to assist with politics?
Well, listen, I can't speak to the motivations of anybody beyond my office. My goal and my only goal in this operation is to get that violent crime rate in check. We had the highest record number of homicides last year. We're on pace to exceed a record number of shooting deaths this year. From my perspective, this effort is only reducing gun violence, saving lives, and making Albuquerque a safer place to live.
That is John Anderson, the U.S. Attorney for the District of New Mexico, who is overseeing Operation Legend there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And elsewhere in the show, we will hear about this from former Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, who has some big concerns. If you miss that on the air, you can find it at hereandnow.org.
The opening ceremony for the 2020 Olympics was supposed to be today, but of course the games have been postponed until next year, and coronavirus cases are surging in Tokyo. Joining us now for more is the BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes, and he's outside of the Olympic Stadium. And Rupert, Tokyo has now more coronavirus cases than it did back in the spring, and it's mostly young people who are infected. What's the government's message about the pandemic right now?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. But compared to North America or Europe or many other countries here in Asia, the Japanese attitude has been very mild. There was quite strong messaging early on, back in March and April. They came out with a campaign called the Three C's campaign. And these were the three situations that you should avoid because they were seen as being the most dangerous. And so people were told, don't go into crowded, poorly ventilated places. Don't go in large crowds and don't have close face-to-face conversations. Those were seen as being the most dangerous things. But there wasn't a lockdown. We haven't had any lockdown here throughout this period. And the advice during the state of emergency was, please stay at home if you can, work from home if you can, wash your hands, wear a mask, do social distancing, but essentially life has gone on here, you know, a new normal certainly, but it's been nothing like what we've seen in Milan or Paris or London. None of that. Life has been going on reasonably as normal.
Businesses are open, schools, camps, those types of things for young people?
Schools closed during the state of emergency across Japan. They have now reopened. Kids are taking their exams this week. Shops are open. Restaurants are open. Nightclubs are closed. Big venues. Sporting events have started to reopen here. There is a baseball match taking place in the stadium behind me here. Only 5,000 people allowed into the stadium. These things are going on. One thing we've really seen here in Japan, it's been very striking, is that up until recently, it has been the behavior of individual people that has kept this pandemic under control here. And the death rate and the infection rate is still very, very low here. But people are maybe getting tired of obeying these rules. People want to go out. It's summer. They want to enjoy themselves. And so we started seeing those infections creeping up.
The Olympics were scheduled to begin today, and the Games were going to give Prime Minister Shinzo Abe a chance to showcase Japan on the world stage. What's been lost now that the Games are not happening this summer?
I think there's a general acceptance that this was necessary, and that it's just not possible to hold the Olympic Games safely here in Tokyo this year. And of course, people are disappointed. People were looking forward to it. A huge amount of money has been spent. We have a brand new state-of-the-art Olympic stadium here in the middle of Tokyo, facilities all over the city. There was huge expectation that Tokyo was going to be in the spotlight of the world this summer, and that's now not happening. But you ask people here on the street, are you disappointed about the Olympics not happening? And they say, look, we've got to deal with this pandemic first. We can't even think about the Olympics until this pandemic is under control. And so there's an acceptance that it has to be moved to next year. And I have to say, quite a lot of people are even skeptical that it will happen next year.
That's the BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Tokyo. Rupert, thank you so much for this update.
It's a pleasure.
Congressman John Lewis will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda early next week. He died last week at age 80 after a battle with pancreatic cancer. We wanted to take a few minutes right now to listen to some extended clips of some of his speeches over the years. Here he is at the Democratic National Convention in 2012 when he recalled his experience as a freedom rider.
We traveled to Rock Hill, South Carolina, about 25 miles from here. When my seatmate Albert Bigelow and I tried to enter a white waiting room, we were met by an angry mob that beat us and left us lying in a pool of blood. Some police officers came up and asked us whether we wanted to press charges. We said no. We come in peace, love, and nonviolence. We said our struggle was not against individuals, but against unjust laws and customs. Our goal was the true freedom for every American. Since then, America has made a lot of progress. We are a different society than we were in 1961. And in 2008, we showed the world the true promise of America when we elected President Barack Obama. A few years ago, a man from Rock Hill, inspired by President Obama's election, decided to come forward. He came to my office in Washington and said, I am one of the people who beat you. I want to apologize. Will you forgive me? I said, I accept your apology. He started crying. He gave me a hug. I hugged him back, and we both started crying. This man and I don't want to go back. We don't want to go back. Brothers and sisters, do you want to go back?
No.
Or do you want to keep America moving forward?
No.
Mine, dear friends, your vote is precious, almost sacred. It is the most powerful nonviolent tool we have to create a more perfect union.
The right to vote was the cause for which John Lewis risked his life at the age of 25. He and more than 600 others marched for voting rights in Selma, Alabama, but were beaten and tear-gassed by state troopers at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Lewis returned to that bridge in March of 2015 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of what's known as Bloody Sunday.
Jimmie Lee Jackson, whose death inspired the Selma March, along with so many others, did not make to see this day. But you and I are here. We can bear witness to the distance we have come and the progress we have made in 50 years, and we must use this moment to recommit ourselves, to do all we can to finish the work. There's still work left to be done. Get out there and push and pull until we redeem the soul of America.
John Lewis spoke passionately about other issues as well. In 2016, he led a day-long sit-in protest on the House floor in Washington calling for gun control after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando.
We have lost hundreds and thousands of innocent people to gun violence. Tiny little children, students and teachers, mothers and fathers, daughters and sons. And what has this body done? Mr. Speaker, nothing. Not one thing. We have turned deaf ears to the blood of the innocent and the concern of our nation. We are blind to a crisis. Mr. Speaker, where is the heart of this body? Where is our soul? Where is our moral leadership? Where is our courage?
10 years prior, in 2006, Lewis delivered a speech at the groundbreaking ceremony for the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, the first monument on the National Mall to honor a black American.
I will never forget the first time I met him. I was 15 years old in the 10th grade in 1955, growing up on a farm outside of Troy, Alabama, when I heard the voice of Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio. He was talking about Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott. He was talking about the ability of a disciplined and determined people to make a difference in our society. When I heard his words, I felt like he was speaking directly to me. I felt like he was saying, John Lewis, you can do it. You can make a difference in a struggle to defend the dignity of all humankind. Growing up in the heart of the segregated South, I saw those signs that said white men, colored men, white women, colored women, white waiting, colored waiting. As a young child, I had tasted the bitter fruits of segregation and racism, and I didn't like it. I would ask my mother and ask my father, why segregation, why racial discrimination? And they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in trouble. Don't get in the way. Martin Luther King Jr. inspired me and thousands of other Americans to get in the way. He inspired us to get in trouble, but it was good trouble. It was necessary trouble, and that's why we honor Martin Luther King Jr. today.
It wasn't far from that site on the National Mall that a 23-year-old John Lewis gave one of the most notable speeches of his life. He was the youngest person to speak at the March on Washington in 1963.
Where is the political party that would make it unnecessary to march in the streets of Birmingham?
Where is the political party that will protect the citizen of Albany, Georgia? Do you know that in Albany, Georgia, 9 of our leaders have been indicted not by the Dixiecrats, but by the federal government for peaceful protests? But what did the federal government do when Albany Deputy Sheriff beat Attorney C.B. Kane and left him half dead? What did the federal government do when local police official kicked and assaulted the pregnant wife of Slater King and she lost her baby? Those who have said be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now. We do not want to go to jail, but we will go to jail if this is the price we must pay for love, brotherhood, and true peace. I appeal to all of you to get in this great revolution that is sweeping this nation. Get in and stay in the streets of every city, every village and hamlet of this nation until true freedom comes, until the revolution of 1776 is complete. We must get in this revolution and complete the revolution.
Lewis was the last living speaker from that historic day. He died within hours of his friend and civil rights leader C.T. Vivian, who was also a freedom rider and an active member of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. A private funeral was held in Atlanta yesterday. C.T. Vivian was 95. Funeral services for the late Congressman John Lewis will be held at the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta next Thursday, following Lewis lying in state at the U.S. Capitol. Lewis's family, by the way, is encouraging people to host virtual events to honor him instead of traveling to Washington because of the pandemic. They say people can tie blue or purple ribbons on their front doors or in their front yards to commemorate his life. You're listening to Here and Now.
The San Diego Comic-Con, the largest convention in North America, is underway this week. But fans, of course, won't be swarming the city's convention center this year. Instead, they're joining panels and events online. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to discuss the all-virtual Comic-Con and how it's shaking up the entertainment industry. Welcome back, Eric.
Hi.
So Comic-Con gets bigger each year. It's packed with conference halls full of A-list celebrities, visual effects, all that kind of stuff. How are TV networks adapting now that they don't have that same in-person platform?
Well, it's been really interesting to watch how all of this is constructed because, you know, Comic-Con, for anyone who's been there, is this immersive experience. I mean, part of the charm of it is that you are in San Diego with thousands of your closest geeky friends. You know, you go to these conference halls and you watch the casts of different shows or movies talk about their projects. You go to a huge exhibit hall and you can see all this material that you can purchase from. And then, you know, once the day's events are over, there are nighttime events. It's a whole immersive experience, and they've tried to recreate that online. So there's a huge homepage that will lead you to all these different things. Of course, they have panels that they have recorded through video chat. So they, you know, the Star Trek franchise did a huge one where they featured a table read from the cast of Discovery. You can also click on links that will take you to other websites. For example, FX has created, so you can kind of page through an experience that they've created where you can see a few interviews. Amazon has a page where, of course, it will encourage you to buy stuff and to watch episodes of shows that may already be released or show you teasers for shows that haven't yet come out. And, you know, some of the efforts are pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you. I mean, I should mention that this virtual conference is free, but do you think that they've nailed it?
I think it's a really good first step. I have a feeling that some elements of this will continue even after they bring back the physical Comic-Con, because one of the challenges of the actual Comic-Con, it's so popular now and it attracts so many people
It
is really hard to get to all the popular, especially the popular, events. You don't have to physically go to every booth and stand in line in order to see some of this stuff, which you would have to do if you went there physically. Now, people who've gone to Comic-Con quite a bit would say that's part of the experience too. But there is a sense that you have more access and you have a greater ability to sample everything because, you can get on your computer and you can spend as much time as you want going through all of this material.
I want to ask you about something else. So I look forward every week to finding out from you the latest in TV and streaming. And this week on your radar is this new documentary from HBO called Showbiz Kids. It's produced by Alex Winter. He's a former child actor and co-star in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. What do you think of this documentary?
I really enjoyed it. And now, if you're somebody who's covered entertainment, I've covered entertainment for many years. Eventually, you will cover the subject of child performers. It's actually a pretty big pipeline. I'm based in Florida, and there's a lot of kids who start out as performers at Disney or when Nickelodeon was based here. They would start out there, they'd go to soap operas, and then they'd go to LA. And this documentary, I learned a lot. Alex was a child star himself. And he sits down and gets these really intimate conversations with people like Todd Bridges, who was on Different Strokes, Henry Thomas, who was on E.T., and Evan Rachel Wood, who now stars on Westworld. She has this really poignant comment where she talks, there's a segment that talks about sexual abuse and the fact that so many child stars have had to deal with people trying to take advantage of them sexually. She talks about being aware of this, and we have a clip. Let's listen to it.
I know a lot of kids that grew up in the industry, and what surprised me when I got older was finding out that pretty much all of the young men were abused in some way. I was at the Golden Globes. I watched a pedophile win. I knew, not a lot of people know, but I know that he's molested boys in the industry. And I walked out and just started sobbing.
And so to have these kind of intimate, Todd Bridges talks about his allegation that he was molested by his publicist. So these guys are talking very frankly about what it's like to be a child performer. And the subjects are great, not just Todd Bridges and Henry Thomas and Evan Rachel Wood, but also Cameron Boyce, who was a young star who died of a seizure, I think last year. He does a great job of talking to people and really getting them to open up about their experiences.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it sounds like a must watch. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. And Tanya, if that's a must watch, I'll have to get to it after I finish Breaking Bad, which I am almost done with, years late. It's Here and Now. As lawmakers in Washington try to pass more financial relief, we'll talk with economist Mohammed El-Erian about what's needed and about the state of the U.S. economy, from jobs to housing to stocks.
It is very complicated to get an economy that has been subjected to a sudden stop back on track.
That's next time on Here and Now.